Oak session number 13248, reel 1.
Mr. Heal, reel 1. Whereabouts were you born, please?
Portsmouth. My father was in the Navy.
That was in 1914, I think.
1916.
Did you go to school in Portsmouth?
No, we left when I was about 5 years old, and my father was transferred then first to Rosyth in Scotland, then to Portland, that in 5 year intervals, Portland in Dorset, and finally to Gosport. He was a secretary, in effect, and he was sort of like a purser, you might say, on a ship. And he was always in charge of the clerical side of the job. And so I moved from a school. My first school was in Scotland, in Rosyth, which is an ordinary elementary school. Then to Weymouth, and to Weymouth Grammar School, where I've received an excellent education, I'd like everybody to know, at Weymouth. And finally, we came back to Gosport, and that's when I started work. And that was, I was about 17 then.
As what?
Oh, I worked in a tobacco warehouse for the time being, until I was able to apply for entry into the customs and excise, which was my ambition. And once I'd done that, I passed that all right, and from then I was civil servant.
What was your reaction when you heard the news that we were at war with Germany?
Well, I wasn't surprised, because it seemed to me, even though I don't claim to be a very clever young man, it seemed to me that we were obviously heading for this war. And for the time being, anyway, I was more concerned with my job, and which I enjoyed. It was some time before I began to think that perhaps I didn't want to spend the rest of the war in a customs and excise. This is what you want, I take it, it's what you're thinking of.
You could have done that, could you?
Oh yes, I was established. After a year's probation, I was established. And in point of fact, you know, if I wanted to leave the customs and excise, I had to get the board's permission, if I wanted to leave for the duration of the war. And it so happened that in March 1940, the board announced that anybody who wanted to enlist in the armed forces of age 23 or over had to do it within the next 6 weeks. There's a certain date in May, which I don't remember. And from then on, nobody would have, of that age would be allowed to leave the customs. So, as it happened, I had a close friend and the same age as myself. We were both 23. That made up our minds. We decided we wanted to go in the RAF and wanted to be pilots.
But what did you feel about the war itself? Did you feel it was necessary to fight it?
Oh, absolutely. I never had any doubts. Once I began to learn about Hitler and the Nazis, I had no doubts at all. I didn't even hesitate. But I could have stayed on the customs and had a quiet time in the war, but my pal and I, we lived in the same digs, we talked a lot about it, and we came around this conclusion, which was reinforced, or which was brought to a head, when this decision by the board was made. We had no doubts at all that we were going to, if possible, going to go in and join the fight.
When war was declared, what was your opinion about Britain's prospects in the war? Did you think we were going to win?
Well, no, I don't think so, and I don't think many people did. At the time, it all looked, we weren't prepared. Neville Chamberlain hadn't taken any strong side. He'd been fooled about the treaty with Poland. And Hitler had signed his forms and 6 months later had torn them up, so in effect. It was obvious that Hitler couldn't be trusted, but at the same time, I felt, you must think I'm a young man of 23, so I'm not very experienced, but I felt that we weren't prepared. In fact, I knew we weren't prepared, but I just hoped that, given time, that would be adjusted.
How did you go about joining up?
Well, I first, my friend and I applied to the Board of Customs for permission to enlist. And this came through within a matter of 2 or 3 weeks. So we then simply, well, as it happened, this in itself is part of the story. We occasionally in the customs, if you're on a day shift and there's nothing much doing at lunchtime or you've got to go out for a meal, we'd call in at the local pub just outside the dock gates, the Canute. And we would have a drink there and a sandwich. And so did the commanding officer of the RAF embarkation unit in Southampton Docks. And we got to know him. And when he heard that we'd made up our minds to join the RAF as air crew, he said, well, I'll have to warn you. He said, you're going to have to wait a long time. He said, there's a lot more people want to go out and fly than we've got planes for them to fly in. So I said, well, that's fair enough. But one thing I said I'd like to ask you, now, I'm an asthmatic. Have been all my life. But I found out when I was 7 years old, I was told by a specialist that the cause of my asthma was a cat. And from then on, I avoided cats indoors, and I kept very, very well, very fit. So I said to this RAF officer, what's the medical exam like for air crew? And he said, he told me about it, and he said, you know, it's quite ordinary. I said, what about sort of, you know, your chest and that sort of thing? Well, you have a test, he said. They give you a tube with a bulb of mercury in it, rather like a thermometer. And you have to blow in at the bottom, and you have to hold this bulb up to a certain point for 1 minute. And that's the test. And that's all our crew have to go through that test. So I thought, oh, yes. So I went home, practiced holding my breath, and did this every day until the time came for us to be called up for the RAF. And it did improve quite a bit. And sure enough, at Uxbridge, where all the new entrants were processed, I eventually found myself in front of the medical officer, and after the usual checkup, she gave me this thing and said, I want you to hold that in your mouth and hold it at that point for a minute. So I put it in my mouth, took the deepest possible breath, and blew into it. Well, he stood there holding his watch, but of course I couldn't see what the time was. I was just watching this bulb of mercury. And because eventually I had to give up, say, sorry, that's a bit. And I looked at him, and he looked at me, and he said, well, I think you'll do. Something like that. And I think it must have been a very close thing. So there we are. We were processed in that way, and then sent back to Southampton. So you'll be called up in due course for flying training. In the meantime, you know, you carry on with your job. You want me to go on with this?
Please, yes. Yes.
Right. So back we went, and eventually, I think it was in May 1940, we were called up for the RAF, and we spent the first 12 months of our service in the RAF just filling in time. Now, there's another interesting little point here. This squadron leader, Bert, that we've been talking to in the pub, he said, oh, by the way, he said, you know you'll have to wait a long time. I could do with a couple of service policemen in my unit. Why don't you see if you can come and join me while you're waiting for air crew training? And, of course, the thought was horrifying to us, a bit of service policeman, and we put a good face on it and said, oh, we'll see what we do. Well, as it happened, after we'd been in various RAF stations filling in time, we were sent to Southampton as service policemen. So obviously he'd used his influence somehow, and I spent the next 9 months in Southampton and also at Calshot RAF standing on the dock gate as a leading aircraftman with SP on there, very often alongside one of my former customs colleagues in his uniform too. They must have wondered what was happening. Anyway, that's by the way. In May 41, we were called up for proper flying training. That is to say, we were sent to Newquay, and we had 6 or 7 weeks there, classroom stuff, learning to be someone in the Royal Air Force learning to about meteorology and trigonometry and all sorts of things. And at the end of which course we had an exam and we both passed, and we were sent for real flying training. Well, we didn't really expect to be sent to the same place. That would have been too much to ask for. But when my friend was sent to South Africa and I was sent to Canada, we thought they couldn't have put us farther apart if they tried.
This was the Empire training scheme.
That's right, that's right. And it was more than that, actually, as you'll see. I over to Canada, Moncton, New Brunswick, which was like the Axbridge of Canada, greetings, processing area. And I was then sent for training to Pensacola, Florida. And I was one of the first group of RAF air crews who were taken in by the USA for training. This was an agreement they'd made only a short time before, and we were the first ones in Pensacola.
So you did your training really at Pensacola
rather than
Moncton?
Yes, Moncton is just a sort of a bring people in, send them somewhere else, and that's all they did, nothing else.
In transit?
In transit, that's right.
Well, what did you think of the training scheme in Florida?
Well, we soon found out that this was the U.S. Navy, Naval Air Force, that they had a very high reputation for their flying skills and their flying training. And I agree with that now, because although I flew some 20-odd hours solo, I didn't last the course. And there are things like, I want you to take this steerman trainer up. I want you to, there's a field over there, a proper airfield. There's just a large white circle in the middle. You fly around at 800 feet. You cut your engine, and then you glide down, and you have to land in that circle without any engine. Well, I didn't make it. You know, I did it several times, but that was only one thing. I really wasn't a natural-born pilot. So when they called me in and said, oh, sorry, but we think you would be better off doing something else in the aircraft, they sent me back to Moncton, who said, what do you want to do? I said, without any hesitation, I'd like to be a navigator, or an observer, as it was then. It became navigator later in the war. Right, they said, we'll accept you for that. And they sent me then back to Pensacola, Florida. Another 36-hour train journey where I had to learn to be an observer. Anyway, I had no trouble with that at all. That sort of paperwork was well within my scope. And
were you very disappointed at not being a pilot?
I was at first, but I began to feel that with my flying training, that somehow, you know, I could never know what's going to happen next, and I would never know whether I'd be able to cope with something. I think I was not a bit surprised, and in fact, I think I was the best thing possible for me.
Did the Americans have a different way of going on in their Air Force at Pensacola from what you were used to in the RAF?
Not really. They had their own personal little ways of going on, but it was basically just the same. Just the same.
Was the discipline the same?
Yes, yes. They treated us very well because we were, in a way, strangers and guests, you might say. Oh, and incidentally, we weren't allowed to wear uniform because the states weren't at war. We had to wear grey flannel suits. But I found them very friendly, and the local people welcomed us, and I made several friends there. It was very nice indeed.
So, because I asked you about the training, because one hears that the Americans are more casual.
Well, what they're like today, of course I don't know, but their training, I thought, was a little, almost too careful. Well, I did wonder afterwards whether if I'd been training in England or somewhere in the British Isles, I might have got through. But they weren't having anybody that would be up to their standards. Whether this was the same with the American Air Force, I don't know. But certainly the U.S. Navy prided themselves on their reputation and their abilities. And I would go along with that. Mind you, I didn't think the observer training was quite as good, but still.
What criticism did you have of that?
Well, as I didn't actually have a criticism, but when we got home, we were sent to an advanced flying unit where we more or less had to do it all again, this paperwork. So it seemed to me that they didn't perhaps think too much of the Americans' navigating us training. But I'm only guessing at that. We had to go through it all again anyway. It may be that just they weren't ready for us. We were filling in time. Who knows? But anyway, I did...
What main methods of navigation did you learn in 42?
In 42?
Yeah, in Pensacola.
Oh, well, we learned astral navigation, of course. I've got a photograph of us sitting there, you know, taking shots of the sun and the stars at night. And then we would go out in the Catalinas, 6-hour trips over the Bay of Biscay, over the Gulf of Mexico. And six of us, say, to each Catalina, and we would practice these astro shots, and we would each have our little log and chart, and we would work out and really do it, go through it quite thoroughly. And it was just a matter of finding your way around, and whether at any time of the day or night. Of course, if it's pitch black at night, there's no stars, nothing, you haven't got much to go on. But dead reckoning, of course, is the basis of navigation. You work out on the wind you're given before you start, what course you're going to set for your first leg, and you take note of any errors you make on the way, so which are due almost entirely to the wind, and adjust accordingly. But if you have to stick to dead reckoning because you can't get any other information, well, then it becomes a little bit chancy. You can't really say exactly where you're going to end up.
How keen were you to get onto an operational squadron?
Oh, I was all ready to go for that. I think we all were. The training is all right, but it can be a bit tedious and a bit boring, especially if you're doing it, as we were in this advanced flying unit, doing more or less the same as we'd already done. I just couldn't wait. And I think at that age, I was 23 then, wasn't I? At that age, I don't think you think too much about the wider issues. You're sort of living. Your day-to-day job, you're trying to do your best. You know what's the next job coming up, and you look forward to it. And you adjust all the time. And with us in this training, first we were flying Ansons in our training, at night and by day. Then we finished our course, went on to operational training unit where we all switched to Whitleys, and that's where we were crewed up. We had our crews. We were now in Bomber Command, and we were became part of a crew, five crew in a Whitley.
Weren't you in Coastal Command to start off with?
Yes. We finished our course and our training as a crew. And we were very surprised to find that we were sent to St. Ebel in Cornwall, virtually on loan to Coastal Command, because we knew we were in Bomber Command. I'm not touching any air, really.
No.
And we were surprised, but it was interesting because we did 10-hour sweeps out over the Bay of Biscay, and this was a real test for the navigator, and not only for the navigator, but for the bomb aimer in the nose of the aircraft, who would work closely with the navigator and keep him informed through what the thing he called a drift sight of the effect of the wind on the waves below, if there were waves. The strength of the waves and the direction of them was all a help to me in my plotting to keep us on track.
What was this drift sight?
Well, I can't remember what it was like now, but he was able to look through it, and he then would say to me, as far as I can see, the direction of the wind is 075 or whatever, and roughly the strength of so-and-so. And I would work on this, and then I would think, it's changing, it's different, and I would adjust accordingly. And the test came, of course, after 10 hours, when you were waiting, looking for Bishop Rock, which was your landfall. Sir Neville, and that's when the crew would make all their little jokes about what part of Wales we're going to arrive in and things like that, you see. But I'm glad to say that for all our trips, we did about 7 or 8 trips, we got very close to landfall on every occasion.
What squadron were you with?
Well, I've got the number of it. In fact, at St. Ewald, it was not a squadron, it was a number 10 operational training unit.
And you were looking for submarines, were you?
Oh, yes, all the time. And that was what we were mainly there. But of course, anything else that we might see. But to the best of my recollection, all we saw was the sea and the sky for 10 hours. I don't remember ever seeing it. And nobody called out and said there's a submarine or there's a ship. I think it was all just water. But there was training. It was excellent training from my point of view anyway. So, and for the pilot, of course, because we flew at 2,000 feet in the Whitley, and he had to keep this thing in the air for 10 hours and fly the course I gave him.
But possibly your mere presence was keeping submarines down.
Oh, I think that could well be, because there was something like, say 4 or 5 of us going out each day, different tracks, different routes. So we did, I think, serve a useful purpose.
But were there any incidents at all that happened to you whilst you were doing this work?
No, none at all. One of our aircraft, unfortunately, I don't know what went wrong, flew into a mountain in Wales, or some high ground in Wales, and everybody was killed on the return. You see why I was so anxious to get back to base properly, and we did.
And this was the winter of 42-43, according to what you've written down on this form, anyway.
Yeah, that's right. This was all in November 42.
And you were flying Whitleys, did you
say? That's right, yeah, the Armstrong Whitworth Whitley, what they called the flying coffin. Not for his reputation, but just the shape. It was like a long black square box.
What was it like being in the Whitley?
Well, I found it very practical and sensible. I had room to work, and I think most of us did. But I don't remember, it's a long time now since I've been in one, of course. I don't remember much in the way of the details.
So when did you actually get into Bomber Command proper and start operating on bombing operations?
Well, we transferred to Bomber Command proper at Wigsley near Lincoln in January 43. And then once again, now we're still in Whitley's, but after a very short time, we transferred to Manchester's, the twin-engine Manchester, which was the forerunner of the Lancaster. And so we had to familiarise ourselves with this new aircraft, and we carried on with this training with it. And then, in February 43, we switched to Lancaster's.
What did you think of the Manchester?
Oh, I thought it was a fine aircraft, but I understand it wasn't. It had its faults. But you see, from my point of view, I was so wrapped up in my little compartment with it, all my paperwork, and thinking ahead as to what to do in what's coming up, that I didn't think much about the aircraft itself. I was very comfortable. It seemed very reliable.
And what was the number of this conversion unit at Wigsley?
Wigsley.
1654 or
1684? 1654. Here it is, 1654 conversion unit, that's right.
How did the Manchester compare with the Lancaster to be in?
Well, the Lancaster, of course, was probably the best bomber we had, and it was it was a better aircraft, although there were similarities between the two. We felt, now we acquired two new crew members because of this bigger aircraft, we had 7 of us there. We felt gradually we were now really in a first-class aircraft and ready for operations.
Can you tell me about your Lancaster crew, about its composition and the character of the people in it?
Yes. Well, perhaps I should go back a little. then I don't want to do a lot of irrelevant matter. Let's see. Well, there were seven of us. Now, the three were Canadians. Pilot, bomb aimer, and rear gunner were Canadians. And these were that I'd met at Kinloss at number 10 OTU. Number, whatever.
19 OTU.
19 OTU. Well, wireless operator from London, and also a flight engineer now, which we acquired now, with switching from Manchester to Lancaster, two extra crew members, a mid-upper gunner from Scotland, and a flight engineer from near London. I got a photograph of five of them there that was taken recently. Two of the crew died since the war, you know, of natural causes. But there's still five of us left. We are, in fact, the biggest crew still in the being from the dams raid. Kept on about that while we were up there.
And the names of the crew members, can you remember?
Yeah, oh yes, yes. The pilot's Ken Brown. The flight engineer, Basil Fenneran. I'll leave out the two who were not with us. The bomb aimer, Canadian, Steve Oansia. I think he was of Romanian extraction. The rear gunner, Grant McDonald. And myself. Five still left. Did you want the other two that were in the original crew?
Please.
Well, W. Hughstone from London, wireless operator. And Donald Buntain from Scotland, mid-upper gunner.
How did you all get on with each other?
Very well indeed. Very well. You know, I haven't got much to wear photographs. We didn't take many at that time. It's not allowed, you know. You weren't supposed to photograph anything to do with the Lancaster anyway. And that's the photographs we wanted. We got on very well. We had no trouble at all. We were extremely, you know, when we if we had an evening off, we'd go out together into Lincoln and go to the pictures or have a drink or something. But no problems at all.
Were they calm or flamboyant characters?
Well, they varied. They varied a bit. One or two were very quiet. But basically, they were all very interesting people. You know, like to joke and a bit of skylarking about. And we used to play with the Canadians. So if we had spare time or we couldn't go out, we had to stay in camp. We'd play poker in our rooms, in our quarters. I don't know. I couldn't have been better off.
And your first operational squadron was 44 squadron.
44 at Waddington, that's right, which was south of Lancaster, south of Lincoln. I beg your pardon. Yes, Waddington. It was a well-known squadron, 44. The commanding officer was a squadron leader, Nettleton. He was got the VC.
And you joined it in February 1943.
Yes, my first entry here is 6th of February 43.
What kind of an airfield was Waddington?
Oh, excellent. It's got a great reputation five groups. Lincoln is mostly five groups. Bomber Command divided into various groups, and fire group. Waddington was one of its best known, and in a book I recently acquired, there's quite a lot about it. It's one of the original ones. I think the first Lancaster that came to Bomber Command went to Squadron 44 Squadron. In fact, I'm almost sure I can look it up, check that. And it was highly thought of there. I liked it. We did a number of operations. Well, now,
can you remember any of the operations that stick out in your mind with 44 Squadron?
Yes, I can. We went on the 9th of March, we went to Munich. Now, I just learned how to operate G. You've probably heard.